Culture.
Book Review. Behind Books. On the Make. The Bookmakers by Adam Smythe. The Editor by Sarah Franklin.
Long before Amazon dominated the modern book business, delight and discontent were directed at a different alleged monopolist, Charles Edward Mudie. In 1842, the Londoner launched a circulation library. Readers could pay one guinea, roughly $76 in today's money, to check out books for a year, one at a time. Mudie's Select Library, which grew to stock around 7.5 million books at its peak, undercut rivals' prices by a large margin. But it was Mudie's role as a gatekeeper that most agitated critics. Because he bought copies en masse, his interest in or dislike of a title could determine whether a book was published. He tended to exclude novels that might be considered unchaste, but chaste ones that could be padded out into three volumes, helping give rise to the triple-decker novel, which became a staple of Victorian literature. Rarely before the times of Jeff Bezos has a single individual shaped a reading culture with such single-minded control, writes Adam Smythe, a professor of literature at Oxford University. Mr. Smythe's The Bookmakers looks across a 530-year period at 18 people whose work has shaped what people read. Most of them have been forgotten. Take Wynkyn de Worde, a German printer who set up shop on Fleet Street in London in 1500. He published more than 800 titles and accounted for an estimated 15% of all English language books before 1550. There is also William Wildgoose, a binder. In the 1600s, most books were still sold in loose leaf, and it was up to buyers to pay someone to bind the pages together. Wildgoose bound a copy of Shakespeare's First Folio, which belonged to the Bodleian Library in Oxford and was chained to the reference shelf. When the Third Folio came out, the library sold the first in its excess book sale, seeing no use for it. Centuries later, it made its way back. One of Mr. Smythe's themes is books' looping relationship to time. They're objects that bear the mark of their creators, but also their readers, with heckling commentaries and scribbled records of ownership. Another is that books are a resilient technology. Their forms do not break as radically from what preceded them as you might expect. Printed books, for example, resembled manuscripts and coexisted alongside them. E-books look like print books. It is in analysing the book's digital present and future, however, that the bookmakers fall short. Mr. Smythe devotes too much time to obscure creators of zines without focusing on anyone who has made the e-book or audiobook, a staple of modern reading, what they are. Judith Jones, the subject of The Editor, also shaped books from behind the scenes. She edited literary greats, including John Hersey, John Updike and Sylvia Plath, though she passed on publishing Plath's novel The Bell Jar, feeling it was too autobiographical. She saved Anne Frank's diary from the slush pile of rejects and helped persuade Doubleday, the publishing house where she was working, to publish it in America. After others rejected Mastering the Art of French Cooking, she spent years directing its shape, helping turn Julia Child into a household name. Jones was the master chef behind many of the best cookbooks in post-war America. Sarah Franklin, a writer and professor at New York University, makes a convincing case that Jones's invisibility was a function of her era. She was hardly the only woman working in post-war publishing in Paris and New York who was not taken as seriously as her talents demanded. But writers did not mind Jones's lack of status. they benefited from her astute eye and patient correspondence. Books are not the only products of human ingenuity to be shaped by people who are overlooked or forgotten. Yet both the bookmakers and the editor make a strong case that the stories behind the stories people read are fascinating in their own right. It just requires you to read between the lines.